From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. South Africa will hold its first ever multiracial election in April. But as that country gets deeper into the process of democratization, violence is escalating in some of the townships. We'll talk to Black South African journalist Rich Mkando about covering that violence. He writes for Reuters and lives in one of the townships where the violence has grown especially brutal. Also today, the glory days of the Starship Enterprise. We talk with William Shatner about starring in the original Star Trek TV series. It's the subject of his new book. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Fearless, starring Jeff Bridges, and he remembers Federico Fellini, who died over the weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Hillary Rodham Clinton told the American Academy of Pediatrics meeting today in Washington that many of the problems of the American health care system are the fault of health insurance companies. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Mrs. Clinton said that insurance companies increase their profits by not selling policies to people they think will cost them a lot of money. And she blasted the insurance companies for trying to block health care reform, which would change that.
They like what is happening today. They like being able to exclude people from coverage because the more they can exclude, the more money they can make.
The Health Insurance Association of America issued an immediate denial. The insurance trade group says it favors reform that would prevent companies from excluding people with a poor health history, and it favors allowing people to keep their insurance if they get sick or change jobs. But the Insurance Association opposes a major part of the Clinton plan, a requirement that would hold increases in insurance premiums to the rate of inflation. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The Red Cross says that central Bosnia is slipping into chaos with massacres of civilians, forced expulsions, and other abuses. The abuses are the result of ethnic fighting between Croats and Muslims in areas that haven't been seized by the ethnic Serbs. The Red Cross said its workers are witnessing blatant violations of human rights by both sides, including mistreatment of civilians and soldiers held in detention camps. UN peacekeepers said they were prevented from visiting a camp where 22 Croat prisoners of war were reportedly being held. The Muslim-led government later said that 19 of the prisoners were killed in an escape attempt. The United Nations said today it plans to investigate a report that UN peacekeepers in Bosnia were regular clients at a Serbian-run house of prostitution. According to a report in New York Newsday, the brothel was filled with captive Croatian and Muslim women. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
According to the report, the brothel, known as Sonia's Kontiki, was a popular haunt of UN peacekeepers. Located 6 miles north of Sarajevo, the UN troops were seen at times leaving with women who were forced into UN armored personnel carriers and driven off. The restaurant was also used frequently by UN officers who held all-night parties there. The report adds that just 150 feet behind the restaurant, Serb forces maintained a subterranean detention camp where up to 100 people, mostly Muslim men, were held in subhuman conditions. A UN spokesman in New York said the world body views the allegations very seriously and plans to investigate. However, a UN spokesman in Sarajevo dismissed the report as disinformation. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 12 points to close at a record 3,692.6. This is NPR. The Clinton administration has given two states permission to experiment with controversial proposals to reform welfare policies. The administration said that Wisconsin can try its plan to put a 2-year limit on welfare benefits. Georgia will try limiting welfare payments to families who have additional children while they're on the rolls. The governors of Wisconsin and Georgia say that the reforms will reduce long-term dependency on welfare. Advocates for the poor say that the plans hurt poor families because they don't prepare people to find work when their welfare is terminated. Firefighters in Southern California report they expect to have the major fires still burning there under control by tomorrow. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
The devastating Laguna Beach fire has been pronounced out. The big Altadena fire is scheduled to be 100% contained by tonight, and firefighters are aiming to fully contain the other big one in Ventura by tomorrow. Firefighters were helped enormously by the fact that the hot, dry Santa Ana winds did not arrive as predicted. Instead, this weekend brought cool, wet weather. The preliminary total on the damage, 171,000 acres burned, 685 homes damaged or destroyed, and 62 injured, most of them firefighters. At least six of the 14 fires that burned through here last week were set by arsonists, say law enforcement officials. No one has yet been caught, but Governor Pete Wilson has put up a $50,000 reward for tips leading to the arrest and conviction of anyone who set any of the fires. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Prosecutors in New York City said today that they want to drop charges against former Defense Secretary Clark Clifford. Clifford is accused of helping the Bank of Credit and Commerce International conceal its illegal ownership of American banks. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a black journalist in South Africa, my guest Rich Mkando has covered stories many white journalists would have had difficulty getting. Recently, he's been covering the violence in the townships, including Katlehong, where he lives. He's also been covering the peace process and has interviewed Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, who recently shared the Nobel Peace Prize. Mkando has written a new book called Reporting South Africa, and he's visiting the United States. He's a correspondent for the international news service Reuters. He formerly wrote for the South African paper The Star and for the now-defunct Rand Daily Mail. He was one of the first blacks to be admitted to a white South African college. Next April, he'll be able to vote for the very first time when South Africa holds its first-ever multiracial elections. It's the beginning of a new era for South Africa, but Mkando writes that the death of apartheid has been greatly exaggerated. I asked him how much his day-to-day life has changed during the dismantling of apartheid.
It has changed a lot. I can move freely wherever I want to go. I can associate with whoever I want to associate with. I can book into any restaurant or any hotel and enjoy myself. I can have lunch with white colleagues or friends without any raising any eyebrows. And I can talk. Basically, I can do whatever I want to do. I can talk to white right-wingers who never wanted to speak to us before. I can interview anyone I want to interview.
Well, when you came into the studio, I was asking you about some of the photographs in your book, and I was thumbing through them and asking you if you'd taken these pictures or not. And they were pictures of a body that had been set on fire and was, by the time the photograph was taken, it was really half of a body.
That's right.
And there was a picture of somebody who had been beaten and was just kind of bleeding onto the floor.
That's right.
And a picture of another body. And what you said to me was, oh, this is nothing compared to what's happening now.
Yes.
What's happening now?
What's happening now is that the violence is more brutal, actually, rather than actually hack you and leave you to bleed. They make sure that they hack you into pieces. And they make sure that they leave you dead and they burn you and make sure that by the time they leave, you're finished. This is actually encouraged by the fact that there's nobody to help the victims. The police are not there. The soldiers are not there. So these guys have time. They really have time to make sure that you suffer. I can give you two examples, which I still actually wonder whether any right-thinking human being can do that, to spend the whole night at the cemetery exhuming a body, take it out of its coffin, then the next day go around the township dancing and chanting slogans, taking the body out of the coffin and then burning it again to make sure that it's finished. By the time we arrive at the place where this exhumed body had been finished, there were bones. Actually, part of it were ashes, so you couldn't identify the body anymore. So the guy had to be buried twice by the family. Now what happens to the family, the psychological effect of the family? What happens to the people around it? By the way, also 2 weeks ago before I came here, I came across a foot of a man and near a rubbish dump. And I was so surprised, and I felt so bad. I went around the houses there, and I asked what happened. I really wanted to do a human interest story. I don't know whether we should call it a human interest story, but I wanted to do a human interest story about finding the foot of a man near a rubbish dump. And then I spoke to a couple of people around there, and they told me that the guy had sort of was lying there for about 2 days, and eventually his body was eaten by dogs. And the only remaining thing is the foot.
What is this violence about in the townships now?
Well, it's about everything. It's about power, it's about territory, it's about revenge, it's about jealousy, it's about everything. It could have started as a fight for territory, but now it involves everything. It involves all social spheres of life. It's very difficult to know exactly. I have been in this business for 5 years now. That means covering what is going on in the townships. And every now and then I talk to many people, and they tell me different reasons why the things they think this has happened.
I think a lot of people suspect that there's perhaps some outside manipulation behind the fighting between the Inkatha Zulu movement and the ANC, the African National Congress. Do you feel that the fighting between those two groups is being manipulated by people who are sorry apartheid is ending?
Indeed. I said that earlier on that there are many factors that causes violence. There are people who are using the unstable situation for their own means. There are people who kill other people, hoping that the blame will be actually based on Inkatha and the ANC's rivalry. It does happen. That's what the ANC call the third force.
What is the third force?
The third force is supposed to be some people who are organizing this violence nicely and neatly and with brutality. The ANC believes there are some people, but they believe that the third force is merely from the government's security forces that supplies the people with arms to do the killing, that supplies the people with money to travel around the country. There have been many examples of that, but there's not been any tangible proof that this is the case. And many people in South Africa believe there is a force that is actually perpetrating the violence.
So the people who believe there's a third force believe that that force exists to keep black people divided and weakened?
Indeed. Also to delay the end of apartheid, and also to make sure that the ANC is demoralized. Indeed, they have succeeded because the ANC is not the powerful ANC that we saw when it came back from exile in 1990. Mr. Mandela and everyone in the ANC agrees that now they are going to struggle to get 55% of the vote, whereas even people in South Africa said if we had had an election a year after Mandela was freed, the ANC could have mustered 75 to 80%. Now, Mr. Mandela says they are going to fight for 55%. He also said that if the violence is not stopped, 40% of people in Natal and the Johannesburg area, which is the most heavily populated area, are going to stay away from the elections. 40% of the people, eligible voters, are going to stay away from the polls.
You must find it very upsetting to see black South Africans fighting with each other at a time when I'm sure you hoped that things would be much more positive, where blacks would be uniting and in just a much more positive state, ready to vote in the elections.
Indeed. Sometimes I actually wonder why keep on being a journalist and see all these kind of things. Sometimes I wonder people who are not doing this sleep nicely than I am. Sometimes I wonder what can I do to help. When you come across, I remember 2 weeks ago, not 2 weeks ago, about a month ago, about 25 people were killed in one single massacre. People were waiting for a taxi. people waiting to board transport back home from work. And I arrived there, and I saw all these bodies there. I was just dumbfounded. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't react. I just stood there, and my other colleagues were interviewing people. I just stood there. I couldn't move. I just wondered why this kind of thing has to happen now. And again, that thought came to my mind. And I said to myself, there was a lady who had been shot, and she was bleeding there, and she was dead. And she was still clutching her handbag. And on the other hand, she was clutching bread, a loaf of bread. Now, later on, I said to myself, now, this woman went to work this morning, and then she was on her way home, and she went into a restaurant. She bought bread for her children. She wouldn't make it. She's not there. She's not going to make it. And I imagined her children waiting for her, not knowing that their mother has died.
I can't help but think, listening to you talk, that I think for a lot of Americans, we think, oh, it's good news in South Africa. Sanctions have been lifted.
Yes, yes.
Elections coming up in April. They're making such progress. Isn't it great? And I'm talking to you, and all I'm hearing is about severed feet and exhumed bodies that are set on fire. It sounds absolutely terrible.
Yes. But then, again, I have to emphasize that although all these things happen, there's been a lot of progress as far as the convergence of ideas between politicians and political groups. There's been a lot of progress as far as negotiating a new constitution is concerned. There's a very good relationship between the government and the ANC. Mr. Mandela and Mr. de Klerk are now joint winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. Although we in South Africa regard that prize as an encouragement rather than them having done something for peace, it's good news for the country. Look, what I'm telling you, the bleak picture that I just painted is really about people on the ground who have not benefited from this process, who have not benefited from this glowing praise that Mr. Mandela and Mr. de Klerk are getting, who have not benefited from the lifting of sanctions and are waiting for something to happen to them. I talk to a lot of people every day who say to me, where are all these leaders that will come to us and say we must vote for them? We are dying. We are the ones who are dying here. I talk to a lot of people who are saying, oh, God, sanctions have been lifted. Where are jobs now? We are unemployed. And what I'm trying to tell you is that whatever is going on in the negotiating process will benefit the country at the end, but not now. Because people are dying. The country is in deep recession. One in every two black South Africans are unemployed. And the whole country is gripped with fear, although I wouldn't say the whole country is sort of gripped with violence, because Natal and the Johannesburg area are the hardest hit, you see, and they constitute 20% of the country. The other 20% is peaceful, but every now and then they watch Johannesburg and Natal in flames, you see. Now, when Mr. Mandela says to you, if we don't do something about this, 40% of the people will stay away from the pause. This is really bad news, because Natal and Johannesburg constitutes about, well, maybe 40% of the population. And although the other people in other provinces and areas are living peacefully, I don't think in their minds they're very peaceful, because they can watch all these things happening. I don't think they will also dare walk to the polling booth there on April the 27th, because they say, oh, what about if I get shot?
That's what they're afraid of. They're afraid,
yeah,
that they'll be shot by who?
Oh, whoever will be trying to scuttle the entire peace process, you see. I have a lot of friends also who tell me that they don't think they'll be voting. Imagine, I haven't voted for 36 years of my life.
For your whole life.
Let's say, well, I was supposed to vote when I'm 18 anyway. I'm 37 now. For 18 years, I qualified to vote. I haven't voted. Now, this is supposed to be the biggest exciting opportunity of my life. And yet people are not going to take it. I'm not going to take that offer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Rich Mkando, and he covers South Africa for Reuters. He's lived in South Africa all his life, and he's written a new book called Reporting South Africa,
We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. South African journalist Rich Mkando is my guest. I'm interested in what your life has been like as a black journalist in South Africa. You started writing during the years of apartheid. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you've seen a lot of that change. You've written both for South African papers and for Reuters, which is a wire service based in England. So when you started, how old were you when you started writing? And what kind of restrictions were you up against that your white colleagues were not?
Well, I guess I was, at 27 when I started writing. That is 9 years ago, I think. And I worked for the Rand Daily Mail, which was an anti-apartheid liberal newspaper, white-owned, respected worldwide for its vociferous fight against apartheid. And it was tough then. It was tough because apartheid, those were the dark days of apartheid, and the government was passing law after law restricting coverage of certain issues. Basically, what they wanted to do was to outlaw any reports about black dissent against apartheid. So it was very tough for us to work under those conditions. But I think we made it. I can give you quite a number of examples about these kind of laws. You couldn't describe what the police were doing. You couldn't take pictures of police action. Basically, police were given the free hand to do anything, either in front of the media or even if the media was not there. You couldn't report or even quote any ANC leaders who were outside the country. What we depended on was either even reports from outside coming in couldn't be printed by local newspapers. And unfortunately, the scope of newspapers in South Africa was very limited. There are only four or five new English big companies that own English newspapers. So not many. There were not many of them. But I think under these circumstances, we did our best. I remember very well that I was in Washington when sanctions were imposed against South Africa. And I was there in the press gallery watching these guys voting yes or no for the imposition of sanctions. And I was outside during the celebrations. And I remember very well, I wouldn't forget that. And one of the ANC people in Washington came to me and said, "Look, I just want to congratulate you guys. You've done a wonderful job because it was because of you, the media, that the outside world got to know about what's going on in South Africa." And indeed, despite the fact that I was then working for a local newspapers, I was part-time working for Reuters because white journalists find it very difficult and dangerous to go into the townships. So I was sort of a freelancer for Reuters. And they liked my work. That's why they actually employed me a year after I came back to South Africa. When I changed from local to international news business, I didn't know what I was doing. But I don't regret it now because I know I played a very, very prominent role in trying to get the people to know what's going on in South Africa. By the way, the government also realized that although they banned, outlawed any reports in South Africa about police action, about government action, they had forgotten to impose such restrictions against the international media. That's what they then turned attention to. They deported many journalists, including Michael Parks of the Los Angeles Times and Steve Mufson, then of Newsweek, and many others were deported. So the picture was coming from the outside of South Africa being up in flames. So I think indeed we have played a very, very prominent role. And even people in South Africa accept that that we have played a very prominent role in exposing the injustices of apartheid.
Rich Mkando reports on South Africa for Reuters. His new book is called Reporting South Africa. Director Peter Weir is famous for big Hollywood entertainments like Witness, Dead Poets Society, and Green Card. But he also has a more enigmatic metaphysical side, the side he showed in his native Australia during the 70s and early 80s, when he made movies like Picnic at Hanging Rock, The Last Wave, and The Year of Living Dangerously. Now that side shows up again in his new movie, Fearless. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
At first, you're grateful. What you see is a man named Max, played by Jeff Bridges, walking steadfastly through a cornfield, his suit slightly rumpled, a baby in his arms. There's smoke in the air, and gradually you hear screams and sirens, and it dawns on you that what you're watching is the aftermath of a plane crash. That Max has not only survived, he's saved some of his fellow passengers. Now, if you're anything like me, you'd rather be subjected to 9 straight hours of Sally Jesse Raphael than to a single minute of watching a plane go down in a movie. But it's a measure of what Peter Weir has accomplished in this gripping, deeply flawed film that by the time he shows you the crash in its entirety during the movie's last few minutes, you're prepared to see it. Like Max himself, you've grown fearless. That's Max's strength and his problem. Before the crash, he was an ordinary middle-aged guy, a San Francisco architect with a nice wife and a kid. But during the crash, he looks death in the face and realizes he no longer fears it. And when he survives, he feels exalted and omnipotent. That feeling doesn't go away, and whenever it threatens to, he tries to renew it by strolling into traffic or dancing around on the parapet of a skyscraper. Meanwhile, he's grown distant and even nasty to the people around him. Relating to people means compromising, and Max can no longer tolerate compromise. He's tasted life with a new kind of purity and freedom, and now he won't accept anything less. Finally, his wife can't take it anymore, and the audience finds itself siding with her, especially since she's played by Isabella Rossellini in the finest, most touching performance she's given since Blue Velvet.
Talk to me. Tell me what's going on. Talk to me, Max. Every day you have to jump off a roof or stand in front of a train so you can lose your fear? Is that it? What about me? What about Jonah? You're like a crazy person.
I'm not crazy.
Black is white and... I love you. We have lived together for 16 years. They have been great.
Not always.
Yes, always. They've always been great for me. Even when I hate you, I know I love you.
Up to this point, the movie holds you in its grip. The script by Rafael Iglesias, who adapted it from his own novel, is crisp and searching. And Peter Weir combines dread and ecstasy in a way that's utterly hypnotic. But when Max decides to leave his family and seek out a troubled fellow survivor named Carla, played by Rosie Perez, the movie veers off course. By the time Max and Carla are larking through a shopping mall, buying presents for dead people, Fearless looks hopelessly lost in the fog. The movie never really makes its way back to Planet of the Humans, but it still leaves you feeling haunted and raw. And Jeff Bridges' performance is magnificent. He doesn't mind risking the audience's dislike to get at the truth of Max's eerie inner state. Jeff Bridges has taken a lot of risks over the last 2 decades and given a lot of extraordinary performances. Is this the year that Hollywood will finally and officially recognize him as one of the best actors alive?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. He'll be back later in our show to remember Federico Fellini. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Beam him up, Scotty. Coming up, the transporter trick and other stories about shooting the original Star Trek TV series. We talk with William Shatner, who will always be Captain Kirk to Trekkies. His new book tells the behind-the-scenes history of the series. And film critic Stephen Schiff remembers director Federico Fellini, who died over the weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The Senate began debate today on whether to force Oregon Republican Bob Packwood to turn over his personal diary to the Senate committee investigating allegations of sexual harassment. Today's debate centered on the Senate's ability to enforce its own code of conduct. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In an extraordinary Senate session, lawmakers listened as Ethics Committee Chairman Richard Bryan argued the case for enforcing a subpoena that Packwood has so far defied. The committee is investigating allegations that Packwood sexually harassed more than 24 women over the years and used his staff to intimidate them into silence. The debate, however, was not about those allegations. Bryan and the ranking Republican on the Ethics Committee argued that after making some portions of his personal diaries available, Packwood had suddenly turned uncooperative when he was informed that the diaries contained possible evidence of violation of the law and Senate rules. Packwood repeatedly portrayed himself as a victim, saying that he has been branded for life by the committee as a criminal. But Republicans on the committee were as forceful as the Democrats in their demands to enforce the subpoena, and it would be unusual for the full Senate to oppose the recommendation. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Supreme Court has agreed to clarify the rules on the Miranda warning for crime suspects. The court is being asked to decide who qualifies as a suspect and what police are required to do if a suspect makes an ambiguous statement that could be a request for a lawyer. The justices are considering a case in which a murder suspect wondered aloud whether he should talk to a lawyer. He had been told about his right to legal help, but had waived it before making the remark. An autopsy conducted on the body of actor River Phoenix has failed to determine the cause of death. The 23-year-old actor collapsed and died outside a West Hollywood nightclub. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
River Phoenix appeared in a dozen films, among them Stand By Me, Sneakers, My Own Private Idaho, and Running on Empty, for which he received an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. He was a strict vegetarian and had a reputation for clean living, but now drugs are being investigated as a contributing factor in his death. When Phoenix collapsed with seizures, his brother called 911, telling the dispatcher, "I think he's had a Valium or something." Friends reported Phoenix was acting strangely a short time before he died. A spokeswoman for the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office said the toxicological tests were being run and that results would not be available for at least a week to 10 days. Phoenix had won much critical praise for his work. He was scheduled to begin filming Interview with a Vampire starring Tom Cruise later this month. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, stocks closed at another record high. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 12 points to close at 3692.61. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. British Prime Minister John Major has offered to include paramilitary groups in the Northern Ireland peace talks if the groups renounce violence. But Major says no one has been able to persuade extremists on both sides to stop killing. Major was reporting to the House of Commons on a meeting in Belgium with the Prime Minister of the Irish Republic. They've been trying to get new talks started. More than 20 people have been killed in the past 9 days in Northern Ireland's sectarian violence. German authorities have launched an investigation into the beating of an American athlete this past weekend by a group of skinheads. NPR's Deidre Berger has more from Frankfurt.
Authorities in the resort town of Oberhof in the eastern part of Germany say they are investigating five skinheads in connection with an allegedly racist-motivated attack. Last Friday, the U.S. National Luge team, who was in Oberhof to train for the Olympics, was the target of racial insults from a group of as many as 17 hooligans. When one of the team members objected to the taunts, the skinheads beat and injured the 26-year-old athlete. The incident occurred in front of a disco. The town mayor apologized to the U.S. team before it left a day early for Innsbruck, Austria. More than 20 people have been killed and hundreds injured in racial violence in Germany the past 3 years. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Authorities in Moscow have banned Revolution Day demonstrations. They don't want to give opponents of President Boris Yeltsin opportunities for more violence, like last month's uprising. Revolution Day, November 7th, was an important holiday under the Soviets. The Russian government says the country's industrial production dropped 17% in the first 9 months of the year. The report says the overall economy declined 11%. The report says the cabinet is especially alarmed by a 15% drop in national income over the past 9 months compared with the same period last year. Prices have soared in Russia since the government implemented market reforms in 1992. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. How big an impact can 79 episodes of one TV show make? Well, ask William Shatner. After 79 episodes of Star Trek, he will forever be Captain Kirk in the minds of his fans. And let's face it, some of his Trekkie fans are pretty obsessive when it comes to Star Trek. The series concluded in January of 1969, but there's no end in sight to the phenomenon. As if the Star Trek movies and Star Trek The Next Generation weren't enough, last week Paramount Communications announced its plans for a fifth national network, which is scheduled to debut in 1995 with a series called Star Trek Voyager. Why swim against the tide? William Shatner has written a new book called Star Trek Memories. We invited him to share some of those memories. I asked him what he thought when he first saw the costumes.
The designs weren't unknown to me. The sketches by Bill Tice, who was one of the people that died recently, that propelled me into doing the book. I saw the sketches and the redrafting of the sketches, and actually these costumes were made in the way they were and the material they were made, because the shows cost something less than $180,000 per show. Nowadays, that would buy the catering to a television show, but those years ago, you could spend $185,000 and get something decent, although it was a very low figure for an hour show. Even then, we on Star Trek were able to manage with it.
Did you ever feel like you were wearing pajamas?
If you meant, was I sleepwalking half the time, maybe.
It's not what I meant, actually. But...
No, it may have looked like pajamas, or they may look like your pajamas. But I didn't feel that, no. The velour that they were made of stretched a lot. I mean, they were only stood so many cleaning, but the studio would never go for more permanent material because there's always the fear that the show's going to be canceled momentarily. Any show, whether it's a long-run Broadway show or a hit television show, there's always that fear that it may not last too much longer, so we better not invest any permanent money here.
So let's get to the very high-tech special effects.
The shaking of the camera.
Yeah. How are you beamed up?
Well, beaming up was a dramatic device so that you didn't have to have a gangplank go down or an elevator or a shuttle to go from the ship to the shore. So it was an invention of convenience. And it really is just a dissolve. Two blank pieces of film dissolved together with a little spritz in it on the film, a little sparkling, and it's a very simple special effects long since thought of as primitive.
What did you have to do to make it work so that the effect would be convincing?
We would stand on these plates of glass that had lights underneath them, and the lights would go up and down. The camera's rolling. The camera continues to roll, and we get we walk off. They then film the blank, the empty space with the lights going up and down. And what they do in the post-production is cut out our walking off and dissolve the film. The camera has stayed locked off. The camera has not moved and continues to roll. And dissolve the piece of film that has us in standing on the plates of glass and the empty plates of glass that we're standing on. And the dissolve is either, if we arrive, is from the empty to the people standing in it, or from the people standing in it to the empty if we're leaving. It's very simple, with a little scratching on the little sparkling.
So for you as the actor, it was like, stand here for a few seconds.
Right. And in the first several months of filming, we didn't quite understand that the walking off was not going to be there, no matter what we did. We could run, walk, crawl off. It was not going to be there. So we kind of walked off in character, you know, as though this was meaningful. It became hysterical to us months later, as we began to realize the techniques that the simplistic techniques that were involved that required not much intelligence to understand, we thought were highly complicated. Something was happening we didn't understand. We better be in character all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Shatner, and he's written a new book about the history of Star Trek called Star Trek Memories. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. William Shatner is with us. He's written a new book called Star Trek Memories. Now, I seem to remember lots of episodes in which Captain Kirk would go to another planet where a lonely, horny woman would try to kidnap him and keep him for her own.
Yes.
Have I exaggerated the number of episodes like this over the years?
Yeah, not in my opinion. It's all I can remember. The whole thing is fading from view except those beautiful girls.
So did the romantic episodes go over well?
Oh, my God, I look forward to them each week. Who's the girl this week? Who did you bring me this week, said the king. You
know? What are some of the get-ups that
brief costumes. Again, Bill Tice came to my rescue and made those girls as naked as possible, basically because we couldn't afford too much wardrobe, so the less material he had to use, the better, and that was part of it. You know, he'd get some expensive crepe or organdy and use as little of it as possible. You know, a little drape here and a little handful there, and it was enough. It was as risque as television got in those days, and unfortunately, I was the recipient of all that. Risqueness?
Risqueability? Who knows? Yeah. There was an episode in which you were supposed to kiss Lieutenant Uhura, but the kiss ended up being faked. Would you tell us about that?
Well, there was a big to-do about Nichelle Nichols and I kissing for the first interracial. I mean, it's so stupid. It's just, even to tell it is outlandish. As it turns out, the plot had the two of us, against our will, merge into each other's arms. And then there was going to be this kiss, and then there became this huge discussion by the network and the studio and everybody involved whether there should really be a kiss or not. Everybody was so afraid of what the affiliates might do, seeing Captain Kirk and the communications officer kissing, so everybody got frightened, and it turned out that we never really kissed, and we were doing it against our wills. So, I thought that was just it was just unfortunate, big to do about nothing.
When Star Trek really took off in syndication, mm-hmm. did you feel vindicated and think, I knew it all along? This is a great show, or did you look at its success and think, I just don't get it?
Well, I was removed from it because in those years, residuals stopped after five replays. Well, by the time it got to syndication, it had replayed five times somewhere. So we, the actors, never received any money from the fact that it played innumerable times over the years. We've some of the bitterness that may still reside in some of the actors is as a result that their faces have become extremely well known, but they haven't been compensated commensurately.
But what did you think of the show's success?
I was astonished. Who would have thought that a show, it was just a phenomenon.
I mean, like I said before, did you feel vindicated? Did you feel
No, it was more I don't get it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't vindicated by any means. I thought it had its natural life. You know? We struggled against odds and made something work for 3 years. Again, in itself, was unusual.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Shatner. He's written a new book called Star Trek Memories. William Shatner, I'm going to play a record.
You what?
Do you know what's coming?
I have no idea.
Okay, here it comes. This is you.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
William Shatner, this record has become a kind of a camp favorite over the years.
So it seems.
Yeah, what's the story behind how you made this record? Whose idea was it? What was the idea behind it?
Well, it was a concept record, and
the album was called The Transformed Man.
Right, and what I had attempted to do there was combine speech and song so that there are excerpts from classical plays that precedes that cut. Now, Loosing the Sky with Diamonds was LSD. And I don't quite remember the cut that precedes. I think it's Cyrano de Bergerac with the speech that ends, I may climb to no great heights, but I will climb alone, that had original music written to it. So it in effect, were lyrics to a song, to a musical theme. Segues into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which is a drug song of a person who can't climb alone. So the idea was amorphous, perhaps, but it was an honorable idea. What's happened is nobody plays the cut that precedes it. They play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Although listening to that, if you were to take a drug song and if you were to visualize colors and kaleidoscopes, you might have some fun thinking of a new interpretation of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
So you still like it?
I listened to that little cut. I didn't mind that. My voice is a tenor there. That's a long time ago.
Sometimes I put on the TV on Saturday afternoon when they have their like monster horror chiller theater type show on, and you're there battling the spiders.
Yeah, another cult favorite. I have become a cult favorite over the years for one or another of things I've done. I've got to get into the straight world soon.
Now, what about Rescue 911? Where does that fit in?
I think that's the straight world.
That's the straight world?
Yeah. Rescue 911 is tremendously successful. And on November 23rd, we are putting on a special show celebrating, dramatizing the 200 life saved by people who have watched the show. That means at least 200, and I know it's far in excess of that, 200 lives have been saved as a result of watching that show, and we dramatize some of those lives, and it's very, very moving and a great honor to be connected with something as like Rescue 911, who's affected that mm-hmm. number of people.
So did you go to the Star Trek conventions now?
Not really. I've been on occasions, especially when there's a movie coming out or a book that mm-hmm. I'm selling.
Do you find the obsession of some fans almost scary?
Well, it can be. Obsessions can be scary, although for the most part, for the large most part, the people who go to those conventions are having a ball. They're having fun, and they're playing with with a show and a concept and an idea that is fun to them. It brings them together. It brings them, unites them as friends. And a lot goes on in those conventions that is very warm and wonderful and admirable. Some of the fringe element are a little way out, but that's what fringe elements are.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Shatner's new book is called Star Trek Memories. This is Fresh Air. Today's the day of Senate debate on the Packwood Diaries. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that debate on All Things Considered?
Terry, Nina Totenberg is at the Capitol covering the debate for us on whether the Ethics Committee should subpoena the diaries of Senator Robert Packwood. We'll have reaction from Oregon, and we'll also have a discussion about public figures keeping diaries. We'll also have reports from New Jersey and Virginia, where they're having gubernatorial elections, a story on the Los Angeles school system and parents who want to make it work better for their children. And the Times Mirror Center has done a study on what Americans think our place in the world is.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Yesterday, one of the world's most famous film directors, Federico Fellini, died in Rome at the age of 73. Fellini won 4 Oscars for his movies La Strada, The Knights of Cabiria, 8½, and Amarcord. He won an Oscar for Lifetime Achievement in March. Fresh Air producer Naomi Person spoke with our film critic, Stephen Schiff.
Stephen, what do you think Fellini's place is in the pantheon of great filmmakers of this century?
I think, in a way, Fellini is kind of a luxury in the history of cinema. I mean, he's sort of not integral to it and not necessary to it. He comes out of a tradition of makers of artifice that includes Georges Méliès and Joseph von Sternberg, back with The Scarlet Empress and all those Marlene Dietrich films, and finally reaches its height with Orson Welles. I mean, the amount of really clever artifice in movies like Citizen Kane and even Touch of Evil. And Fellini has that same willingness and need to make something more than real and make something more elaborate and larger than life and more cartoonish and more crazy and just to pop your eyes out of the skull. But it was Welles himself who once said of Fellini that he showed, I'm quoting, dangerous signs of being a superlative artist with little to say. And I think that's true of Fellini. That condition, having abundant talent and skill and yet nothing to articulate with it, is the theme of his one single truly great movie, I think the movie that will last, 8½. It's a phantasmagoria about an artist who really has all the gifts but has nothing to do with them. He used to like to talk about the cinema as being a circus and life as being a circus. And circus is not the highest of art forms. A circus is kind of on the level of, if you'll pardon me, dumb spectacle. And Fellini was a maker of spectacle. He was a maker of visual images that proclaimed their artificiality and proclaimed their kind of grotesquerie and their wore all their humor and all their heart and all their nostalgia and all their sentiment very much on their sleeves. You know, all those yummy colors and billowing cellophane seas and, you know, all those tootling marchers with their little brass horns and fat people leering at the camera. It all is Fellini-esque, that's for sure. And when we see it in life, which is not too often, we say, oh, my gosh, it's Fellini-esque. But actually, it's really a sort of a tic or a mannerism. It's peculiar to him. And in a way, once it's been enunciated, it doesn't have much more to say about itself. Fellini, in a way, became the kind of prisoner of his own mannerisms as he went on.
Fellini started out as one of his early jobs was as a cartoonist. Do you think that had any, like, relation to where he ended up or how so?
Well, yeah, exactly, because Fellini has a cartoon sensibility. It is, first and foremost, a visual sensibility. I mean, he really didn't care much about performance or even about character, so much so that he would dub all his actors. He was famous for having huge international casts from Africa and from Middle Asia and from Europe picked for their looks. And he would have them sort of stand around counting in their native language. And then he would just dub in whatever dialogue he wanted. And it always sounded fakey, as we might say, and it was. It simply was. He had raised artifice to such a level, though, that something realistic would have been strikingly out of place.
One of Fellini's later movies was Ginger and Fred, and it was about an Italian couple who had danced, and they had taken their names from Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. Do you think that Fellini took anything from American movies?
I think he honored American movies, and like almost everyone making movies in Europe at the time that he did, he saw the Americans as leaders in the sort of making of mainstream commercial cinema and the invention of cinematic technique. But there's really not an awful lot of American influence on his movies. You know, Fellini retreated into the world of the studio, Cinecittà, just as American movies were breaking out into the real world, into you know, the real streets of cities and into the real sort of plains and onto the road of middle America and finding out what lighter equipment and smaller sound recording equipment could do to free up a director to make something more authentic and real. Fellini, of course, went in just the opposite direction.
What was Fellini's influence?
I think, in a way, he's had almost none, really. I mean, he influenced Woody Allen at his worst. I mean, and when you're saying that the influence of Fellini was even worse than the influence of Bergman, you're really saying something. Almost no one else that I can see on the contemporary scene really takes a leaf from Fellini's book. I mean, these mannerisms that we came to call Fellini-esque are really his and his alone. And maybe that's as it should be. I'd hate to see someone trying to imitate Fellini.
Stephen, the actor River Phoenix also died this weekend he was 50 years younger than Fellini. He was 23. He was an actor who received a lot of critical acclaim for the risks he'd taken in his roles.
Yeah, that was just a very haunting tragedy. You know, River Phoenix was so young and so full of potential, and you picked him right out from the moment you first saw him in the movie Explorers in 1985. And then in Stand By Me as sort of the tough, intimidating, but very young kid, he was so striking. He had such presence and such a very clear devotion to the work and to exploring character at a really precocious age. He made this movie, My Own Private Idaho, a couple years ago, in which he played someone with narcolepsy who seemed to be living in a sort of strange, tragic, surreal dream world. And just the feeling of this early and unexpected death associates itself in my mind with that role. And it's really sad and really haunting and a real loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Stephen, for talking with us.
Sure.
Stephen Schiff spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. Stephen is Fresh Air's film critic and critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landau. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the first woman to become chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller. She isn't the product of a traditional upbringing. At age 11, her family was uprooted from their farm by a relocation program and ended up in an urban ghetto. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.